At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
Today, we got a crazy episode for you. You know, we've been thinking of other ways we can bring you more paranormal content. And one idea that we had was diving into police encounters with the supernatural. Because if you think about it, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, they're showing up to potentially like really intense scenes a lot of the times. First responders are going into intense situations. Lots going on.
And a lot of different locations too.
Yeah, all over the world, really.
Because obviously, you know, we're going to talk about some very grisly crimes, but we're also going to talk about just, you know, some different places that police, you know, go to investigate, whether it's actual reports of, you know, paranormal activity. And, you know, at the time, may not seem that way, but it just makes a lot of sense to, you know, take a look at what first responders are experiencing when it comes to the supernatural. And I wanted to shout out, I know we have one police officer out there. I've seen you comment before. You listen to the podcast on graveyard shifts. You know, I just want to say a mad respect for police officers. I think you guys have probably one of the hardest jobs out there. And, you know, sometimes I can be quite critical of law enforcement. I know I've definitely been ripped apart a few times for my takes on law enforcement. But when it comes to police officers and policing, that is a tough job. And, you know, I have nothing but respect for you guys. Obviously, there's some bad apples out there, but there's bad apples in every type of job. So yeah, that's what we're going to be covering today. Before we jump in, though, I wanted to remind you that we do still have some Lights Out merch available over there at lightsoutcast.shop. I'm actually wearing the Candle Flash tee today. I think it's the first time I've worn it on the show, I think. And the Bison Ritual long sleeve still out there. The blanket is still sold out, but we are restocking that. So keep an eye out for that restock. Hopefully it'll be here in the next week or two. But yeah, support the show. One way you can support the show that's absolutely free, though, is just subscribing to us on YouTube or wherever you listen or watch the podcast. Spotify, I think it's following, and Apple Podcasts, I think it's subscribing. Really appreciate it. But we're not going to waste any more time. Let's just jump into our first story here. This, forewarning, this one is very, very sad. And but it's pretty wild how all the events unfold in this one. So our first story on the list of a couple different police paranormal encounters deals with disembodied voices near a tragic car accident, and some believe it was the call of a protector. On March 6, 2015, 25-year-old Jennifer Grosbeck drove through Spanish Forks, Utah, about 50 miles south of Salt Lake City. Jennifer's 18-month-old daughter, Lily, was also in the vehicle, and they're returning home to Springville after spending the evening at Jennifer's parents' house in Salem. Just before leaving her parents' house, Chad Grosbeck, Jennifer's father, was aware that she had just taken clonazepam, which is a drug used to control anxiety, seizures, and spasms, and he urged her not to drive home and even offered to drive them himself, but Jennifer refused. Chad then checked to make sure Lily's car seat was securely buckled into the backseat of the car before they drove off. He also, quote, watched as she left to make sure she was driving okay. And then around 10:30 p.m. that night, Jennifer was driving across a bridge over the Spanish Fork River when she lost control of her Dodge Caliber possibly falling asleep at the wheel. She then crashed into the cement barrier and then flipped over the edge. Her car then smashed into the small, icy river below, landing upside down in the shallow water. And because of where the vehicle landed, it was very difficult for anyone to see from the road above. And it wasn't until 14 hours later, at 12:24 p.m. the next day, that a fisherman spotted her car upside down in the Spanish Fork River. And that's when he immediately called the police, but he only thought it was an empty stolen vehicle that someone might have dumped there. When the first responders arrived, they spotted the Dodge Caliber upside down in the shallow water. Meanwhile, Chad, Jennifer's father, had driven over to her house because he wasn't getting a response from her on the phone. When he got there, he didn't find her, so he drove around town looking for her. Eventually, he gave up and headed back to Salem, where he saw the first responders crowding around the bridge and river area. As he approached, even before seeing the vehicle, he knew in his heart that the accident involved Jennifer and Lily. Down in the river, four officers approached the vehicle, and all of them heard the distinct voice of a woman saying, "Help me, we're in here." Officer Tyler Badeau said the voice was, quote, "clear as day." The officers then got into the chilly water and lifted the car on its side, where they spotted Jennifer and Lily inside. Jennifer was unresponsive and would later sadly be declared dead as a result of blunt force injury of the head. As for her 18-month-old daughter, Lily, she was miraculously still alive. Lily had spent 14 hours upside down in her car seat in the wreckage, and she had been suspended just above the icy water rushing beneath her, which is absolutely crazy.
Isn't that wild?
That she was still alive after being upside down above that icy water. So you're talking very, very cold temps.
Thankfully, she was strapped into that car seat securely.
Officer Tyler Badeau said, quote, "We could see her eyes fluttering, so there was some life, but as far as movements or consciousness, there was nothing that we could see." The officers had to spend 20 minutes in the cold water attempting to rescue Lily. At some points, the water was up to their necks. They had been so focused on the rescue mission that many didn't realize the effects the water was having on them, and all four officers and three firefighters were later treated for hypothermia. Meanwhile, they removed Lily from the car as fast as possible. And four officers and three firefighters then formed an assembly line to pass Lily to the officer closest to the shore. And we actually have a clip from the body cam footage, which we'll show you now.
Tragically, they can see the driver, Jenny Grossbeck, was fatally injured in the crash. But the situation was about to take on an even greater sense of urgency.
Anybody hear us? Hello?
Oh, God.
There's a baby.
God. There's a bear, Brian. Oh. Brian, get up here, though.
Moments later, a firefighter pulls what seems to be a small, lifeless body out of the car.
Got it. Here, pass her up. Here, right.
The officer and an EMT carry Lily up the rocks and run to a waiting ambulance.
Come on, baby. She's definitely hypothermic. She's freezing.
Throw up in there.
Here, go. Let's go.
The officer starts patting her on the back, hoping she will start to breathe, and gives Lily encouragement to live.
Come on, sweetie.
17, go ahead.
Come on, sweetie.
They begin giving Lily infant CPR and trying to warm her up as the ambulance rushes to the hospital. No one can feel a pulse.
We're almost there. Are you getting a pulse? Couldn't feel any.
She was later transported to Primary Children's Hospital, where she regained full consciousness and her condition was stable and improving, and she returned home soon after. A medical examiner later ruled that Jennifer, who was driving the vehicle, had been under the influence of heroin as well as clonazepam, THC, morphine, codeine, hydromorphone, a small bag of marijuana and some tramadol, and a syringe were later found in the vehicle as well. Jennifer's family members claimed she was studying medical assisting and suffered from back issues because of a previous car crash, which was a possible explanation for the drugs. But the question still remained: if Jennifer had died from a head injury soon after impact, and the only other person in the car was 18-month-old Lily, then whose voice had told the officers, "Help me, we're in here"? All four officers who were in the water confirmed that they had heard the same thing. And many believe that the voice was the spirit of Jennifer Grossbeck drawing attention to her daughter who was in need of rescue in the back seat. The officers agreed that the voice triggered their adrenaline rush to save whoever was inside. So that's, man, I don't even know what to make of that.
I know, right?
Help me, we're in here.
I tried to listen to the body cam footage, see if you could hear anything early on, but there's nothing there. If anyone wants to go check out the body cam footage and watch like the long form one, you can. I couldn't hear. It might have been before that body cam footage began, but yeah, pretty wild. And it, as much of a tragic story as that is, I'm really happy that Lily made it out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. Yeah. I wonder, I mean, could have been just their adrenaline was pumping and maybe they thought they heard that and they didn't really hear that. But then again, like, had they not heard that voice, would they have continued looking? I mean, it was very clear that this was a fatal car crash. So, you know, they could have just assumed that there's nobody else inside the vehicle. It was just Jennifer, and they didn't attempt to, you know, go as far as they did to try to rescue Lily.
Yeah.
I mean, good thing they did though. So yeah, that's a crazy one though.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Our next story on the list involves, unfortunately, one of the most tragic events on U.S. soil. And this involves a ghost jogged from memory. So NYPD Sergeant Frank Mara, who's now retired, was one of the officers who had to sift through the rubble of the World Trade Center towers in September 2001. Years later, in 2013, while he was conducting interviews for his book called From Landfill to Hallowed Ground, he remembered encountering something paranormal during his long hours of work at the site. The large team searched through the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island, which they called The Hill. Roughly one-third of the rubble from the World Trade Centers was moved there, which was about 1.6 million short tons. Thousands of detectives and forensic evidence specialists worked for over 1.7 million man-hours at this site. More than 1,600 personal items and a final count of 4,257 human remains were retrieved at this site. Unfortunately, only 300 of these remains were ever successfully identified. Sergeant Mara supervised the vehicle impound section of this landfill. So while researching for his book, another detective asked Sergeant Mara if he had ever seen a strange woman handing out sandwiches at the site. And he said this question, quote, hit him like a ton of bricks. I had put that dormant. He had repressed this for years, but sure enough, the detective's question jogged his memory. So while working for hours on end on the hill, he recalled seeing a black woman dressed in a Red Cross uniform. She was often seen near the sifters carrying a tray filled with sandwiches and coffee. Normally, I mean, this wouldn't stick out in a disaster zone, someone in a Red Cross uniform. But some noticed she was oddly dressed in what seemed to be a World War II era uniform. And this was a shin-length white dress and a Red Cross patch on her breast pocket. She had visited many more of the workers several times at the site, but they didn't think much of it until years later. And Sergeant Mara often recalled seeing her, but only from about 50 plus yards away. So she's always kind of across the landfill site. And when he would kind of strain his eyes to see who it was over there, because obviously she looks a little out of place, the woman would always kind of walk behind a mound of rubble and just vanish into thin air. A psychic medium later explained that the woman was an entity, possibly a soul collector, and her goal was to guide the spirits of the dead into the afterlife. Some soul collectors are depicted as like spirit-like demons who prey on souls of the dying and ferry them into purgatory. Not even hell, just purgatory. But in other cases, such as this one, the soul collector was simply ferrying them into the afterlife to be at peace. And Sergeant Mara realized that the hill had become much more than just a landfill while working there. In his book, he later wrote, quote, as time passed, we realized how many people's ashes and DNA still remain at the landfill. It was clear this became a holy ground, a place of rest for many who would never be recovered, a cemetery without tombstones. Very sobering story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, God, that's crazy though, that he wasn't the only one that saw this entity or apparition this woman.
Yeah. It was corroborated by quite a few people.
That's crazy.
I know. And I was really young at the time, and I don't even remember this landfill, really. I guess the news cycle was so crazy during this time. I don't think a lot was being put onto this, you know? It was a kind of bigger things going on, but I didn't realize that, you kind of don't think about where do they haul that stuff, after a tragedy like that? What happens?
I mean, it's crazy to think that there's so many people's remains that are still in this landfill.
Yep.
And only 300 were able to be identified.
Out of 4,257.
Yeah, that's crazy, man.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
So our next one, we're actually moving across the pond here over to Glasgow, Scotland.
Hell yeah, I love Glasgow.
Yeah, I have some family who live not far from there.
Are you're Scottish?
I'm not. I think maybe a little bit, mostly Polish, but I do have Scottish family.
I have a decent amount of Scottish in me.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a good portion.
I could see it.
Yeah.
I think it's stereotypical that Scottish people are like on the bigger end, like they're tall.
Yeah.
And big dudes, but I could see it. You should start wearing a kilt.
Yeah.
In the office.
Every day.
I think you could rock it.
I mean, it's hot out, so.
Yeah. It's the season.
Keep it breezy down there. But beautiful country.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning. And the people couldn't be nicer.
I need to go and visit. I know.
Loch Ness is there.
Yeah, true.
Maybe do a lights out field trip to go see the Loch Ness Monster.
Definitely. Go for a nice swim.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe coat myself in honey and and peanut butter or whatever the Loch Ness Monster is attracted to. Who knows? But anyway, in 2016, a malevolent entity forced an unnamed family from their home in the Rutherglen neighborhood. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. I know Scottish people,
you probably got it wrong, but it's okay.
I know. Your guys' accents are very thick, so I apologize. A panicked family member called emergency services 2 days in a row, which was on August 8th and August 9th. Claiming that their house had been experiencing bizarre occurrences, and in the home there lived a woman and her son, and they were just desperate for help. When police arrived, they anticipated a mental health issue with the mother or the son, or possibly both. But it didn't take long for things to go haywire. Articles of clothing began soaring across rooms, the oven door kept opening and closing on its own, lights were flickering, and lampshades were turned upside down when the lights came back on. And this is hilarious. In the backyard, there was the family's pet chihuahua was just hanging out, minding its own business while everything was going on in the house. And it was later spotted awkwardly sitting on top of a 7-foot-tall hedge in the garden.
Which, chihuahuas are small dogs.
Yeah, tiny. How would it get up
there? They've got some hops, but 7 foot?
Yeah.
How'd he get up there?
I just like I just like that image. The chihuahua
just like shaking up, sitting on top
freaking
of him.
Out on a 7-foot edge. The officers who first arrived at the house became so concerned they put the investigation on quote active inquiry and returned to their station to tell everyone what they had witnessed. And word spread all the way up the chain of command in the Police Scotland, which is Scotland's national police force. A local paper quoted one of the officers quote, "These were incidents that were witnessed by our own officers, incidents that are not easily explained. One problem we've got is, where do we go from here? As no crime has been established. So what else can we do but deal with any reports of disturbances? Officers with more than 20 years of service are saying they've never seen anything like this. It really is something that down-to-earth police officers are having trouble getting their heads around. How do you handle what, despite us not liking to use the word, has been described as a poltergeist?
Seems like we need to get police officers trained in exorcism.
Yeah, right.
And paranormal investigation as well.
I feel like a lot of the paranormal stories we cover involve police rolling up to houses with poltergeists.
It's poltergeist it's activity common. Usually. Yeah. Well, especially since, I mean, with poltergeists, it's very obvious what's going on, right? Because you're seeing physical objects moving around, which, I think all three of us here want nothing more than to experience a poltergeist in action.
What happened to our didn't we have a crucifix?
Yeah, right? Where did that go?
I want to see that thing move.
That thing disappeared. Yeah, we'll have to find that.
Yeah.
But remind us what a poltergeist is in case...
Yeah, we've covered these many a time, but if you're unfamiliar, it's one of the most common factors of the noisy ghost, as it's kind of translated to, infesting a house, is the presence of a teenager. This is often a very common thing to have in a house where a poltergeist is, and that would be true in this case. We do know there was a teenage boy living here. Scotland's demonologist Jason Love also supported this theory, and he believed the poltergeist had been feeding off the teenager's energy. This is a very common theory. Even high-ranking officers visiting the house witnessed the poltergeist activity for themselves, and the strange activity continued for 2 days straight. Police provided social workers and doctors to the family in the meantime. When the story reached headlines, the police and the family, who were self-proclaimed devout Catholics, requested a Roman Catholic priest to visit the house and perform a blessing, hoping this would solve the problems. Unfortunately, nothing really helped.
How about seeing if it continues with the boy out of the house?
Yeah, I know.
That's like,
why
always
don't they ever test that?
Like, just if you think a poltergeist is feeding off this teenager's energy, send the teenager away. Yeah. Send him to the movies for an afternoon and then see if it continues.
Yeah. Put him in a public library and get some video cameras on that asshole and let's see if shit keeps moving.
Right. It's always a step that's never done, it feels like. But yep.
So the family just ended up moving out of the house. They said, screw it.
Which is like, when that happens, you're like, okay, maybe they did do that step, or I don't know. It's like, that's a pretty big thing to just like, guess we gotta leave.
That's it.
Damn noisy ghost. Can't keep it down.
Yep. Maybe it's a good way to break a lease.
You just tell a clause in there?
There's like a really superstitious landlord or something, and you're like, yo, this place is haunted. And they're like, okay, yeah, no, you're good. I don't want any more of this.
I wonder if landlords have to disclose paranormal activity in their leases.
They should.
You should look at your lease, see if there's a paranormal act. You should ask them.
There's like a 40-page addendum on paranormal activity. So yeah, they ended up moving out of the house, and they were physically unharmed, but really the emotional toll was heavy, as is the case with a lot of these. They moved in with relatives until they could find a new place to stay. Police, meanwhile, checked the history of the property to see if anything stood out, but they found nothing. So in the end, some believe it was all a hoax actually staged by local teenagers, possibly friends of the family's teenager. And many pointed out that one of our favorite movie franchises, The Conjuring 2, which is a movie about the Enfield poltergeist, which we've covered.
Probably the most famous poltergeist case.
Of the Warrens, yeah. Yeah. And that movie had been released just earlier that year. So some thought that maybe just the teenagers were inspired by this and they were actually hiding around the house, throwing things, flickering lights, placing the chihuahua on a 7-foot hedge when no one was looking. This is just
how dumb do you think these cops are?
I know, like, that's the
thing. I didn't see the kid running behind the hedge
with
the chihuahua.
Exactly.
What are they, like, setting up wires?
It would have to be pretty elaborate.
Fishing line throughout the house, and they, like, somehow, like, have a mechanism to, like, throw clothing across.
Yeah.
That'd be so obvious,
I know.
Like, when you see a hoaxed paranormal activity, you're like, clearly it's hoaxed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's very easy most of the time to discern.
Yeah. Unless you're like an actual stage illusionist with like very practiced
Unless like things. Chris Angel's helping out with this somehow. Or Because it's like, really, these cops are going to, you know, go on the record and say that they saw this if it was hoaxed?
Yeah.
And, like, and it's also insinuating. Yeah.
It's kind of stupid.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's also insinuating that, oh, these guys were such devout Catholics that they, you know, they just couldn't look past their beliefs.
Yeah.
To see the hoax that was really going on.
Right.
It's like, yeah, come on, no, man. Like,
also, I don't know, like, maybe one buffoon police officer, I could be like, okay, whatever. He might have been tricked. I could see that. But the fact that there was multiple people going into this house and experiencing it, you know, I think it's at least interesting enough to.
Unless they're all in on it.
Credibility to. Oh, yeah.
Some elaborate movie promotion.
The police, you see the police officer flicking the light, and like another one's moving the lampshade. Like they're just pranking the rookie officer.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it could be, but I don't know, man.
Yeah.
And they said they investigated it and found no evidence.
Yeah, no.
Of it being a hoax.
Or criminality. So there you go. Take that as you will.
I wanted to talk about selling a haunted house. And in 1991, the New York Supreme Court case Stambofsky versus Ackley, also known as the Ghostbusters ruling, came forth.
The Ghostbusters ruling.
The Ghostbusters rule.
Nice.
Essentially, if you advertise the house as publicly as haunted, you do have to make note of that in the papers when selling it.
Hmm.
So in New York is the only place where you have to disclose that the house is haunted.
Interesting.
Hmm.
But it's only if you
publicly advertise.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you advertise,
come
it as
rent
such.
My haunted house.
Yeah, yeah.
Want to levitate out of bed at night?
And the reasoning behind it was because the buyer of the house was saying it devalued the house over time.
Ah,
so it was more of a money thing than actually danger.
That's interesting. I would kind of assume it would do the opposite, because I could see some weirdos being like, I want to buy it. Kind of like me.
Yeah.
I would want to buy a haunted house.
If you're a skeptic, yeah, yeah. Like, you'd be like, oh, this is cool.
Let me see. Yeah.
But there's a lot of people that believe, and maybe they don't want to live. Because, I mean, a lot of people, you got to remember, attribute paranormal activity to something demonic and evil.
Yeah.
So I can see how that would be a major negative to be like, oh, there's evil in this place.
True.
Why would I want to move my family there?
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's a poltergeist that feeds off my teenager soul.
Yeah, it's putting chihuahuas on hedges.
Yeah, I don't want my dog on the roof, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I can see that, how it devalue the property.
For sure.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
But this next one deals with a phone call from the dead. St. Louis Police Department has had its fair share of paranormal activity throughout the years, and one of the most famous stories began on November 26, 2006. Officer Sean Heifele and another officer were sent over to Runyon Avenue at about 10 p.m. An unnamed person had come into the St. Louis County Police 4th Precinct Station requesting a welfare check on their extended family at the 200 block. They hadn't been seen for days. Three family members who had lived at the home were missing. Michael Polite, who's 59, his sister Nedra Flippo, who went by Carol, who's 56, and their mother Norma Manilakis, who is 76. Family members and neighbors of the missing family also told police that it was unusual for the family not to be there, and that a light brown Chevrolet minivan belonging to Michael had been missing from the home for some time. When Officer Heifele arrived at the home, no one answered the door. When he and the other officer began searching around the property, that's when cracks of a rifle sounded off. Someone inside the home, a 38-year-old relative of the missing family named Anthony Lynn, went by Tony, opened fire from the home's window. According to the relatives and police, Lynn had suffered from mental problems and become more agitated recently. Police also later confirmed they had been called to the house back in January on a domestic incident when Tony had threatened one of the residents, his grandmother, 76-year-old Norma. Tony shot Officer Heifele twice with his rifle. He was soon rescued though and taken to the hospital where his wounds were treated and he ended up surviving. Back at the house, a 5-hour standoff with police began. Police fired off 10 tear gas canisters inside of the home, and it wasn't until 4 a.m. early the next morning when Tony climbed from a window onto the porch roof. He then pointed his rifle at a St. Louis County Police Tactical Unit officer, but at that point, I mean, the house was surrounded, police had guns on it, and they opened fire before Tony could get a shot off, and Tony died soon after. Not knowing what else could be inside the home, police then sent the bombing and arson unit's robotic camera inside. Officers wearing gas masks also searched the house twice, but found nothing. When the missing family members didn't show up, police began searching other locations where relatives thought Tony might have taken them. They searched the River de Perez and a spot along the Mississippi River where the family said Tony had a favorite fishing spot, but they still found nothing. Police then released a license plate number and a description of the missing minivan to the public. The van would soon be found on November 29th, 3 days after the shootout. It was about a block away from the family home, parked in an alley. It had been obscured by several pieces of construction equipment, hence why they hadn't found it earlier. When officers inspected the vehicle, they found no one inside. It was full of Michael's camping gear. They towed the van to the St. Louis County Police Forensics Lab for more investigation. Detectives and canine units searched the surrounding area where the van was found, hoping to find another clue, but found nothing. Meanwhile, Michael's son and daughter, Michael and Kimberly, along with a few of the other family members, were inside the home on Runyon. They were searching for Tony Lynn's U.S. Marine uniform they planned on burying him in. They headed into the basement where three closets were hidden away by furniture and piles of clothing. Inside one closet, one of them spotted a human hand jutting from one of the piles of clothing. This was one of the bodies of a missing family member. All three missing family members, Michael, Carol, and Norma, were then discovered in the same closet. St. Louis County Police Chief Jerry Lee later apologized during a press conference saying the department, quote, made a mistake not discovering the bodies when they initially searched the home. When police reinspected the basement closets, they realized the bodies had been placed in a secret closet, basically a closet within a closet. The cause of death for both Carol and Norma was blunt force trauma to the head as well as multiple stab wounds. With the case closed, Officer Heifele, who had been shot, was now back on duty. Other officers informed him that they had begun receiving phone calls from the Runyon Avenue home, despite the phone line being disconnected. Each time a call came in, the caller would immediately hang up. So Officer Heifele investigated the mysterious phone calls himself. He headed back over to the house while out on patrol one day, and as he approached the house, his skin started to crawl. He felt an eerie presence as he stepped foot on the property. While searching around, he noticed the electricity had been shut off and the windows had been boarded up with wood, so he couldn't see inside. Four crosses, one for each of the family members lost, had also been staked in the yard. Officer Heifele said, quote, "It looked like a house from Nightmare on Elm Street." That day, he decided not to enter the house. But as the days passed, the house and the mysterious phone calls kept clawing at him, so he finally returned to the house and got up the courage to investigate the interior. After sundown, Officer Heifele entered the home with his flashlight in hand. He said that's when, quote, "things got weird." As he flashed his light through the pitch black house, he noticed a Ouija board had been set out. The planchette still rested on the board, and as he drew closer, he noticed that the planchette sat on the letter U. As we know, the planchette still being on the board meant that possibly the previous session might have never been ended, meaning this could have opened up a portal for spirits for an unknown amount of time. After a sharp breath, Officer Heifele felt like the planchette was pointing at him. So he continued on, deeper into the house, further into the darkness. When he came to the basement stairs, he could still smell the lingering scent of tear gas. Down in the basement, he found the minibar had been set up with wine glasses, like someone or something was waiting for him to arrive. He walked slowly across the room, keeping the light in front of him, and he approached the hidden closet where the bodies had been, and he felt a freezing gust of air pass by him. He said, quote, "it made the hairs on my neck and arms stand straight up." He then took a moment to say a few final private words to the victims before rushing out of the house. And that's when he said he felt an invisible force constricting him all the way until he got back into his squad car. And from that point on, no more calls from the house on Ronan Avenue came into the station ever again. This story, to me, sounds almost like something out of a horror movie.
Right?
I mean, I'm just like, see all these things playing out in my head. I'm like, God, that must have been terrifying.
Yeah.
A Ouija board set out? Like,
I know. Yeah, right? Jesus. Like, had someone broken in and they were doing a Ouija board session in there?
Must be.
Or did that, or was the Ouija board from before the incident even occurred?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you would think that they would have noted that when they searched the whole house, you know, after the standoff, but maybe they missed it and just didn't notice it at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like they missed a lot. Also,
that'd be terrifying.
I think also one of the scariest parts of this is just the officer showing up to the house for a missing person's, like, a welfare check and then getting shot.
Ambushed. Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrifying.
That's like every officer's worst nightmare is to be ambushed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's terrifying.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So our next story involves some rare CCTV footage of a potential ghost. And this is what I'm always asking for. Where's hard evidence? Yeah. I want to see it. So on September 20th, 2014, Officer Carl Romero was working his usual shift at the Espanola police station in New Mexico, where he spotted something odd. Officer Romero had been keeping his eye on the CCTV surveillance cameras set up around the station when something moved in the Sallyport. The Sallyport is an exit area of the station, kind of outside, gated. When he re-inspected the footage, Officer Romero believed he saw an apparition walking across the secured lot. The entity moved right through a set of cages and a gate. He then immediately reported the sightings to his superior. So let's take a look at this footage.
They're tough guys, but some police officers saw something that freaked them out, and they captured it on camera.
It's an image that some people say appears to be a ghost walking around the police station. Nancy Laughlin has the video and talked to the men who shot it.
It started out as a pretty typical Saturday night. Espanola police officer Carl Romero was on duty, keeping an eye on the surveillance cameras around the station, when he saw something in the Sallyport.
At first, that was like a polilla, like a fly, a moth. And then I saw the legs and it was a human.
But not a real human.
No, it was just a ghost.
So Romero reported it and told his supervisors. Detectives showed us the camera that captured the image. They say there is no way in or out of the secured area without an open gate and alarm sounding.
You can see it walk through. It walks in the direction of the old transport cages. And there's not really any way for it to get out through there, but it seems to walk right through that.
Detectives say there's no logical explanation for this, not an issue with the lighting or a technical glitch. Turns out, there are a lot of ghost stories around here.
A lot of our officers have seen certain things. Some of our officers have felt what appears to be somebody breathing down their neck as they're working on reports in the briefing room.
Cops at the station also report hearing strange noises in the middle of the night and seeing unexplainable images in the lobby area, too.
What do you make of that?
My first question is, why are their surveillance cameras such low res?
I know, right?
Like, dear God.
If someone were to like come in there and attack the police station or break in,
you couldn't even see
their face.
It could be a raccoon or a human. I mean, that's the first thing. So if you're listening, it's very low res. But I will say, you do see what looks like a white, like an all white movement.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of at first just looks like a ball, you know, but then as it gets closer to the gates, it does look like there's legs walking.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because it does look like a piece of dust or something just floating. But you can actually make out like kind of feet moving across.
Yeah, it looks like legs moving. And then it kind of like it exits through the gates and then it takes like a left immediately and like looks like it walks down the sidewalk or something.
Yeah.
But as you saw, like this thing is high gates all the way around it. So clearly from the footage, somebody didn't like walk through and then hop over the fences or anything. It went right through the fence. Yeah. So very strange.
Yeah.
I mean, it was strange enough to make the local news. I mean, true, they're pretty psyched about it.
Yeah. Maybe it's a slow news day or something. But no, I'm not sure. I mean, if I had to guess, probably not to, you know, I'm always a stinker about it, but probably dust.
So you think dust?
I think I'm a big
dust with legs.
I'm a big Occam's razor guy. It's usually the simplest answer, you know, but I don't know. The feet do look suspicious though. It's not like a simple particle of dust.
It's a complex particle.
It's a complex. It's an intelligent.
It's AI driven.
Yeah.
I mean, they say they see this kind of stuff all the time. So
true. Yeah. And detectives said no one could enter or leave that secured area without the gates opening and an alarm sounding. And yeah, like you were saying, the officers claimed this wasn't the first time the station had witnessed some weird paranormal activity. They had even heard strange noises and witnessed unexplained images and apparitions down in the lobby of the station as well. So Officer Romero, he couldn't explain exactly what he saw in the video, but he did believe in ghosts, and he figured it might have something to do with the unsolved murders in the area at the time. Police claim the building is not on a burial ground, as far as they know, and no inmates have died in the holding cells. So, yeah, what was on that CCTV footage?
Let us know. What do you think it is?
Yeah.
Because I think it was a ghost. It was clearly a ghost. Had legs.
True. Yeah. It's hard to explain the
legs. I mean, if you look at it, and maybe this is just the shitty, like, re-uploaded version of it.
Yeah.
Like, so maybe the actual, I'm hoping the police station cameras are actually better than what we saw.
Yeah.
The resolution's a little bit crisper.
Yeah.
I mean, you really think that they would make such a big deal about this if it was a fucking piece of dust?
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Like, well, that's how slow the news cycle is out here. We're reporting dust. That's the thing is, like, why? Is it just because it's fun and we're like, if it's dust, fuck it, it's a ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's what I always struggle with. It's like, really?
Like, why would we put this much energy into something if it wasn't something? Yeah.
There's probably an actual crime that was committed that didn't get coverage because they put this on. I'm serious. Like, there's probably something bad that actually happened. They're like, no, we're going to show the viewers this because this is hard evidence.
Man, I will say, after all of it, good on Officer Romero for being like, yeah, even though so it's ghost sighting, we're having fun, but also he's like, it might be because of all the unsolved murders we have in this area. He kind of brings it back home to like, we still have problems here that we got to figure out. Maybe this is emblematic of a larger issue. I like how he tied that back in.
Yeah, that's good police work right there. So our last story for today is a little bit different than the others. I don't know if it quite falls into the realm of supernatural per se, but it's definitely dealing with spirituality, which is very, very interesting. And, you know, what happens after death?
Yeah. And I figured you would like this one too, because we were just talking about the concept of reincarnation the other day. So yeah, I find this one fascinating. It's not your typical ghost story, but let's dig in. So Robert Snow, who is now a retired captain from the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, during his career, he was in charge of the Department of Homicide and Robbery and the Department of Organized Crime. After 30 years in the field, he went on to publish several books on police work. So keep that in mind. This is a seasoned veteran here in the police department. So during a party, Robert was approached by a police psychologist, and he actually, just to preface, he does have experience in psychology. We'll get into that a little bit later. But during their conversation, she claimed she had conducted past life regressions as a hobby and that she could guide her clients into a relaxed state until past life memories emerged. Big claim. Robert's first thought was that these memories, they were all fabricated.
Kind of like you.
Yeah, sounds like me. It's a fucking smug piece of shit. He even
Wow. Poor Robert, man.
Oh, I'm more that was more directed at me than at Robert. He even gave his opinion straight to the police psychologist's face. Whew, that's something I would do too.
You smug piece of shit. Fabricating this. Oh my God.
So I like her response though. She, instead of taking offense to this, she took it as a challenge rather than an insult. And she dared him to try it. As a joke, he agreed, but he didn't immediately follow through. So as the weeks passed, the police psychologist kept bothering Robert about it and even called him scared.
Oh.
Tried to call him out.
Kind of taunting him a little bit.
Little scaredy cat. So eventually he caved, and Robert got a referral to another regression therapist and scheduled the first available appointment he could. He felt the need to go through with it so he didn't backtrack on a dare. Going into that appointment, Robert did not believe in reincarnation or past lives and had no expectations of experiencing anything meaningful. He greeted the regression therapist, Dr. Mary Ellen Griffith, and he lied down, closed his eyes, and she asked him to picture his higher self entering the room and greeting him.
What if somebody said that to you?
I would genuinely.
Do you believe in a higher self?
I mean, possibly. I'm open to the idea. I'm not like against it. I would 100% put myself into this.
Yeah.
I would even be less smug than he is. Cause he's like, nah, nothing's gonna happen, no expert. I would be like, I'm very open to this experience. I wanna give it my best shot. So yeah, I would go into this with a very open mind.
We'll see what we can arrange.
I would do that on
see
camera.
If we can find
too.
Us a regression therapist, because
I would do it.
I think it's very interesting.
We'll do the we'll do bonus episode. Josh and Austin do regression therapy.
Yeah,
find our past lives.
You ever wonder what your past life would be?
I know what they are. I've accessed them before. Garbage man one time. Really good at bass guitar. His name was Steve. Before that, I was actually the president of the United States.
During the Civil War?
It was... it was... Taft.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, yeah. They had to crane me into bathtubs and stuff. That was fun. Before that, I was just a peasant farmer. And that was the happiest I ever was during medieval times.
He's totally serious, by the way. Yeah, if you're dead serious. Wondering what his face looks like right now. Totally serious.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Anyways, back to the story here. So Robert later asked himself, what the hell was I doing there? She then asked what his higher self was wearing, try and picture him. So he decided just to play along and said he was wearing a long white gown. Trying to picture, he's like, oh, what's a typical spirit look like? Kind of still a little bit bullshitting the process here, but
yeah, he's not really understanding what the goal is here.
Exactly. So Mary Ellen told him his higher self wanted to take him on a journey if he was ready. So as a vocal skeptic, he still agreed to follow through with this. And although he thought it was just a big joke, he really did try and stay serious. So shocked during this whole process, Robert would experience powerful and detailed past life memories during this session. He even later claimed these memories were clearer than waking consciousness.
His higher self's like, I'm going to wake you the fuck up. Yeah. Man. You doubt this shit?
I have never achieved something clearer than waking consciousness. I want to know what that feels like, honestly. It sounds fascinating. But he ended up remembering several different lifetimes. And the one that stuck out the most was him as a portrait painter in the 19th century. This memory was so detailed, he later listed 30 specific things from that experience. And his experience was later summed up into 12 points in his book, Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic. So here are the 12 points that he could recall and sum up. We'll start from the top. Number one, he painted a portrait of a hunchbacked woman. Number two, he painted portraits to make money, but hated painting portraits. Three, he used the name Jack. Four, he used a walking stick. Five, his wife and he spent time in France. Six, his wife could not have children. Seven, they were desperate for money and he argued with his wife about money often. Eight, despite their problems with money and the inability to have children, their marriage was ultimately happy. Nine, he had an art studio with a bank of skylights and a row of windows. 10, he once stayed at an estate with large gardens. 11, a female relative died of a blood clot. 12, he died in a large city with tall buildings in the fall of the year 1917. Very specific on that last one.
Do you feel like some of these aren't specific enough for you to be a believer at this point?
No, the vagueness, I think, is more convincing because...
Right, if it was like super
detailed, yeah. You're like, okay, he just like read about this and snuck it in or something, you know?
But remember these 12 points because they do come into play here later on in the story. So after the session, Robert was so impressed, but he was still skeptical. He needed to know if the past life memory was real or if he was guided into an intense fantasy. He still didn't believe in reincarnation by that point, and he thought that the life of the painter was just a forgotten memory he had already learned about, maybe through a book, school, or museum, so he decided to investigate. He treated it like a police case. He researched art books, he visited art galleries and museums, and even reached out to art dealers asking if they'd ever come across a portrait of a hunchbacked woman. Even as an experienced researcher with years of experience in police work, he came up with nothing, and after a year of trying to find the portrait of the hunchback woman, he came to a dead end. When he gave up on his search, his wife Melanie suggested they take a vacation trip to New Orleans to celebrate their wedding anniversary. Robert agreed, because he doesn't like to go to New Orleans, right? He felt like the vacation would be a great way to take his mind off of things. On the last day of their vacation, Robert wandered into an art gallery in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And in some cosmic coincidence, guess what was there? A portrait of a hunchback woman. Here's how Robert described the discovery. Quote, "Whirling around, I stared open-mouthed at the portrait, reliving an experience I'd had once when I grabbed onto a live wire without knowing it, the current freezing me in my tracks as huge voltage surged up and down my arms and legs. For the next several minutes, I didn't move from in front of the portrait, but instead continued closing my eyes to see again and again the scene of me painting this very portrait in my studio and then opening my eyes to see the actual finished portrait. The situation began to feel surreal, more like a very vivid dream that you wake up from sweating from, a dream that you have to keep telling yourself over and over again was only a dream. It wasn't real. For a moment, he told himself he had just had a stroke. None of it was real. Maybe he was in a hospital bed, hallucinating. He desperately tried to find a rational explanation, but he couldn't. He later wrote, "During my 30 years as a police officer, I've always searched for the truth. Sometimes the truth didn't turn out to be what I expected, but still, the truth was what I had always searched for. And now, here I was seeming to be facing the truth I had been looking for, but at the same time trying to deny it, trying to find any way to deny the truth of what I had found. Supernatural things didn't happen to real people. Maybe they did in the movies, but not in real life." He soon discovered that the painter's name was James Carroll Beckwith, an American landscape portrait and genre painter from the 19th century. Robert still thought that maybe he had seen the portrait of the hunchback woman at a museum or at an exhibit. He asked the gallery worker if this was possible. The man told him that the painting had been privately owned for years, and he didn't think there had been a public exhibition of Beckwith's work in the last 75 years. In fact, Beckwith's last exhibition was in 1911, and this was before Robert was even born. In hindsight, some believe Robert's wife Melanie had received a telepathic message telling them to go to New Orleans so Robert could discover the painting. While doing more research, Robert later discovered Beckwith was the president of the National Academy of Design in New York, and this academy had kept his diaries and an unpublished autobiography. Robert read through them all, and according to him, he validated what he recalled from his regression therapy session. And the name Jack,
that he had recalled was possibly the name of someone from another past life. Up until then, Robert hadn't accepted that reincarnation was at play, but after reading through the diaries and autobiography, he accepted that it was the only explanation. Some also claim that Robert resembled Carol Beckwith, comparing them side by side. Take a look at this.
Pretty close. Pretty close. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit, but...
They both have mustaches.
Kind of where it ends.
That's where it starts.
Kind of where it ends, yeah. I think. Because, yeah, I mean, who says you have to look like your past life self?
That's what I was going to say. That doesn't really make sense, right?
I think that's just people just kind of comparing and be like, oh, there's some similarities there.
Yeah.
Robert later visited Carol Beckwith's burial location, paying respect to what he believed was his past life. Beckwith died of a heart attack on October 24th, 1917, at the age of 65. And there's a picture of him standing at his burial location. So it seemed like he really came to accept reincarnation and that this was a past life of his.
Yeah. And I appreciated that he was willing to accept that even some of his points were off. You know, he said he was like, oh, the name Jack really had nothing to do with this guy, even though he thought he did. Maybe it was just another past life or something like that. So I appreciated that he was willing to call out the inconsistencies in it. You know, it just adds more credibility to it.
Yeah, this would be very interesting to personally do and see.
Yeah, it'd be wild.
Yeah, I've had like psychics that claim to be able to do past life readings before, and I'm trying to remember what they said. It was like something very, it was like, you were in Egypt, and I was like, that's exactly what I would want you to say. Right. It's like, oh yeah, I lived in Egypt. Yep. I helped build the pyramids.
Yep.
Like, yeah. It'd be interesting to go, like, I know there is a regression therapist here in the Denver area. Should reach out, maybe yeah. They come on, because it'd be interesting to hear it from their perspective, you know, like a therapist perspective, and how do they do this?
Yeah, and I think, I can't remember. I don't know. I don't think regression therapy
is not like past life. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know.
It's definitely different. I don't know
the ins and outs of it, but I also don't think.
Or it is past life regression. Okay.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah.
Cover what practitioners believe are memories of past lives during incarnations. I think some claim that it's like pseudo, you know, it's like.
Yeah, I don't think it's like an accepted, like, psychological studied science, because I think it's the same, it's on board with like hypnotherapy and stuff. But even hypnotherapy, I had a professor, very grounded, intelligent professor, and she was terrified of flying. She had just a phobia of getting on airplanes. And she said she went to a hypnotherapist and she never smoked a cigarette again, because she also smoked a lot of cigarettes.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
She stopped smoking cigarettes, and she was no longer afraid of flying after hypnotherapy. So
it's very effective for some people.
Yeah. So even though it's not like a generally accepted I don't know where to choose my words here. I don't want to say credible sciences, but it's a bit on the fringe of your typical psychology. But
it's definitely more widely accepted today than it was 50, 60 years ago, it seems like.
Yeah.
But yeah, something we'd love to explore more, because it'd be very interesting. Yeah, it's used to treat a lot of different conditions, generalized anxiety, depression, PTSD, phobias, chronic pain, relationship difficulties, confidence and self-esteem problems, behavioral issues, addiction, and just spiritual growth and discovery. So, yeah, and on this website I'm reading, it literally says this type of therapy is not suitable for everyone, and it may not be helpful in all cases. Yeah. Essentially, you speak with a licensed therapist who can help you decide whether this therapy is the best course of action for your particular needs and objectives.
That's good they add that.
Because again, like risks of regression therapy, a painful memory, other deep emotions might surface during the process of retrieving prior memories.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's very interesting, this idea of interconnected dynamics of body, mind, and soul. So it's a very much like a holistic, integrative approach to health and wellness.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you remember the Chris Bledsoe episode?
Yeah, yeah.
He did regression therapy, and that's supposedly where he was getting all his visions from and whatnot.
Yeah, it is considered a legitimate psychotherapy strategy with origins in ancient healing modalities like shamanism and past life regression in Eastern philosophy. So, yeah, very interesting. I'm wondering what your thoughts are out there around past lives. Do you believe in it? Do you believe in reincarnation? Or are you on the other side? I think it's all just fantasy and made up. I'm curious. Also, let us know what your which story stuck out to you the most here. What seemed the most credible to you, Austin?
Ooh, we're going with credible?
Yeah. Ooh, I got to hit you with a...
Yeah. I could tell you the one I liked. Credible. Okay, let me turn off the stinker. I'll go most credible. Let me scan back a little bit here. I'm going to go Call from the Dead, even though I think there are elements that are fabricated in that story.
Like you don't necessarily think it was a soul collector?
I don't think there was a phone call coming from...
Oh, sorry.
That one, yeah. Officer Heifeli. I don't think there was a phone call coming from the house. I think maybe that was like the other officers razzing him because he actually never got a phone call. They were like, no, that house keeps calling us. But I do think there is something very real that happened with him returning to that house where such a tragic thing, you know, multiple tragic things had occurred, and saying his piece and healing somewhat from it. I think that's a very real thing. Regardless if there was actual, like, you know, ghosts or spirits at play, I do think that story is very relatable and true in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I agree. I think how that one plays out, there's a lot of reasons for me to think that these things really did happen. As far as the paranormal aspects of it goes, you know, if you think about the idea that we've talked about here, like imprinted energy and things like that,
yeah,
is there like this residual energy that's left behind after all these tragic things happen, and how does that energy interact with physical objects? And seems like oftentimes it's with technological items, and so phone, you know, I agree with you. I think the phone calling, like, and it hanging up, like, that'd be pretty crazy, pretty intense energy that could, like, dial the phone and,
yeah, you know, right,
dial the right number, and then, yeah, you know, yeah. What I mean. And but I think as far as, I mean, that's definitely one of the creepiest ones that we covered today. The first story too, I mean, absolutely tragic, and
yeah,
you know, just horrible. That one to me, just, you know, I don't know where I stand on this idea of angels, but I feel like if you believe in negative entities, you got to believe in positive ones as well. You know, like, you can't just pick or choose one or the other. And I strongly believe that there's good and evil in the world. And if there's negative entities, there's got to be positive entities as well. And could it be some type of, you know, whether it's a guardian angel or some type of, you know, spiritual protector of some sort that's just looking out for you, an ancestor perhaps, you know, there's a lot of different ideas around, you know, spirits that are there to protect you and are always with you. That's kind of what I lean more towards. I mean, obviously some people put out there was, you know, her mother, spirit that was reaching out to, the first responders as they were trying to pull her out of the vehicle. But that one to me just was like, I feel like there's a lot of stories like that out there, with first responders were just subtle thing, you know, such a subtle thing. It wasn't so elaborate. It's just like, they heard a voice.
Yeah. And like, they knew they had to get into action,
just, or
yeah,
either they heard a voice or something in their head told them that we, you know, sounded like right, a voice, but like maybe
collectively,
it was just, yeah, exactly.
Like,
maybe
we have
it was,
to do this.
Yeah. It was telepathic, you know, just something spoke to them. It was like, you need to, you know, help me. There's someone else in this vehicle we need to rescue. So that one really stood out to me. But yeah, we want to know your thoughts on this episode. And it's a bit of a different one for sure. Hopefully, Hopefully you found it interesting and maybe learned a few things along the way. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and wrap up today's episode there. Appreciate you joining us, and we'll see you next time. Until then, lights out, everybody.